I would like to present today is the first version, really, of a genuine working paper. Some ideas that I'm working through, really, in response to organizing for this session itself. It's called Born Again Ideology, and it's really just a reflection on the development, the political implications today of the development, the relationship between Reconstructionist Christianity and network capitalism. And then following from the last section, I should just say, maybe sort of, I began to get worried, so I better problematize the question of empire itself. And I really thought, really, my conception, I'm going to speak about American empire today in a very specific meaning, actually, with respect to empire, and that is that I changed the term immediately to hyper-empire. And the hyper-empire that I want to talk about, for a very specific reason, is I want to talk about America today, not as about, in a territorial sense, as the occupation of space. I don't even want to talk about America in, like Paul Virilio, really wonderful terms, as the government of time. Because I think, in fact, in its present formulations, exceeded both of these. In fact, it's a quantum singularity. And it's what I would call a government, you know, an empire of, which seeks to occupy the totality of the fabric of space-time itself. So I'd like to talk about that. And the specific argument I'd make is that what really typifies the American hyper-empire is it brings together two singularities. It brings together ancient theological beliefs as the basis for redemptive violence. And it brings together an absolute spearhead leadership, as Nietzsche would say, and the technicities of cyber warfare and cyber economy and cyber power itself. The bringing together of these two things, one ancient and one really post-human for myself, represents, you know, what makes the American hyper-empire the spearhead of time itself. I have to admit, I was watching, spent a lot of yesterday watching Condoleezza Rice, you know, bolted myself down to the chair and said, oh, okay, let's figure this out. And where Condoleezza Rice says, you know, America has no permanent enemies. And so no one followed up. And so I thought, oh, I wish I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I could have asked a question. But that's pretty interesting. And I thought, well, she's actually absolutely right. But probably right for not the reason that she thinks. Because I suspect that she hasn't read, you know, René Girard's work on sacrificial violence itself, where you don't have permanent enemies because enemies of hyper-empires are always absolutely accidental. Iraq, Iran, the list will go on itself. They're necessary politically for bonding your local population and as sites of sacrificial violence, as a scene of redemptive violence for renewal of the empire itself. In fact, it's a born-again empire, shall we say. So just with that little excursus, let me just begin on this reflection itself, born-again ideology. Of course, I begin with Martin Heidegger to give me guidance in my thought. Martin Heidegger remarked in the word of Nietzsche that you honor thinker best by thinking. And thinking the relationship between fundamentalist religion and contemporary politics today, following Heidegger, I'd like to honor really the 100th anniversary in 2005, this year, of the publication of Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism by rethinking his thesis with and against the currents of 20th century politics. I'd like to argue that 100 years after Weber, that the original compact that he theorized at first in European and later in American political economy between Calvinism and acquisitive capitalism, this migration at first in Europe and then in Puritan America of Puritan attitudes towards personal salvation based on giving witnesses by habits of frugality and hard work and kind of an immense tutelary discipline which will be imposed on the body into the essentially acquisitive spirit of capitalism has now been renewed in the key born-again ideology. Except I argue that we are living now in the age of what I would describe as the post-human Weber, of the development of a new religio-political compact between a self-described Reconstructionist Christianity and network capitalism. So not so much any longer the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism in its original Calvinist evocation of aesthetic propriety and regularity, nor capitalism any longer in its first pioneering acquisitive expression, but the new Protestant ethic of the 21st century, politically reanimated, charismatic, morally renewed, resurgent, redemptive fundamentalist, breaking down the boundaries of private religious belief, this fusion of religious fundamentalism, and the instrumentalities of an increasingly cyberneticized imperial forms of global warfare, is, I believe, the moral essence of the Bush administration's political vision, which they call in their own terms, it couldn't be more perfect to make the point theoretically and politically, redemptive empire. Projective, aggressive, self-confident, Reconstructionist Christianity streamed instantly across the space-time fabric of American empire by a military intent on its own terms on full spectrum domination of space, and as they have recently announced in the new DARPA projects, they're interested in the future in the metabolic domination of the bodies of its global subjects. A dangerous fusion, then, of fundamentalist Protestantism and cyber war. In his first press conference after the most recent American election, George Bush said this, it's already become iconic, "I've earned political capital and I intend to spend it." Now, there are intimations here, some known, such as the sacrificial violence directed against the cities of Iraq. Reports last night on Electronic Iraq, your blog, which does really good human rights voting out of Iraq, which talked of, you know, really radical new weapons using poison gas and napalm that are used in the citizens of Fallujah itself. And how today, as we speak, they're closing off sections of Fallujah and actually bringing in earth-moving equipment to take away the very dirt that was used, you know, that was sort of destroyed by the bombs itself. And the conclusion of human rights workers is that these, of course, are in violations of a lot of conventions. They're experimental weapons, and the evidence itself is being removed. Ominous warnings of adventurism to come in Iran. And some stories, unknown, when reported, almost forgotten, really at the dark edges of the story of the real politics of empire. The probable murder, for example, in a southern motel room in late December of a person named Ray C. Lem. He's a private investigator who was following the trail of something called the Five Star Trust, a really secret fund out of Texas and Saudi Arabia and the Philippines, which he claimed had funded what he and many others on the net have said is the widespread computer manipulation of the last American election. So when I really think of these stories in these kind of times of rumors and circulations and conspiracies and murders that go on, I just really remember in my mind, again, as a iconic phrase, George Bush, "I have earned political capital and I intend to spend it." Or I listened today to the inauguration, you know, second inauguration speech, when Bush says, in a very absolutely chilling phrase, he says, "Today, America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one." And this talk that I'm going to give today is about America's deepest beliefs, and in fact, its strategic unity with its vital interests itself. So consequently, I wish to speak today about politics in the age of the empire from the perspective of what I call born-again ideology. This strange but very real and very intense relationship between the resurfacing of religious fundamentalism in contemporary American politics and cyber warfare by which America projects its imperial ambitions across the planet, this epical meeting in the American political mind of its Puritan religious past, its increasingly militarized version of the post-human future. Now, this is a historically proximate statement. As I speak, celebrity parties accompanying the inauguration are only now beginning. Media rumors circulate about a preemptive military attack in Iran. The cities of Iraq are under a military assault from the land and air, and one which is not animated exclusively by the oligarchic logic of imperial warfare, but by a vision of born-again ideology. In a way that Max Weber can only intimate, we are today really living in the ashes of the Protestant ethic. The supposedly dead resurrection effect, the Protestant ethic, hyper-moral, hyper-monistic, charismatic, and fundamentalist, has suddenly come alive in the imperial language of redemptive empire. Politically virulent as only a dead resurrection effect can be, the Calvinist origins of the Protestant ethic have successfully mutated into the redemptive fundamentalist language of born-again Christianity. Now, in contemporary political cartography, it's perfectly symbolized as a division of America into the chromatics of blue and red states, with its exceptions. Perhaps the red states symbolize a certain psychogeography in the American mind, a massive psychological reaction formation in psychoanalytical terms, imminent and subjective and deeply populist and deeply emotional, which once linked with the instrumentalities of real power, cyber warfare, militarized globalization, external objective elite-driven neoconservative, constitute what we mean now by fascism. In the 20th century, the power libido of capitalist excess was politically constrained by the bipolar, almost frozen opposition between capitalism and the communist bloc. In the 21st century, the century which was initiated symbolically by the fall of the Berlin Wall, the politics of empire, capitalism, and triumphant has now no effective political check. The American empire, the spearhead of increasingly militarized capitalism, is free at last to be what it's always wanted to be, the universal sign, unipolar, unchallenged, self-directing. It's free literally to stamp the political formula on every political coin, e pluribus unum, from many one, on globalized culture itself. Without its socialist binary, without the necessities of maintaining at least the rhetorical pretense of defense of the ideals of democratic rights and economic egalitarianism, empire capitalism swiftly backslides into the specter of fascism. This is, I believe, our immediate political future. And it is, I believe, the immediate political future of the politics of empire. Again, the political formula for the emergence of this type of fascism is this: an imminent populist reaction formation, born-again fundamentalism, sweeping from the southern states to the heart of the heartland of the industrial Midwest and then to the West, combines with the right-wing elitist agenda of imperial politics, the logic of cyber warfare, the project for the 21st century, the American project for the 21st century, full-spectrum domination, to produce a politics of empire which is incipiently authoritarian. Domestically, politically threatened by the human rights struggles of gays and lesbians, this psychological reaction formation, this really virulent backlash against the politics of difference, fuses emotionally around issues of same-sex marriage, pro-choice, immigration, the restriction of welfare rights, and the weakening of gun control. Globally, it projects itself outward in the language of resentment and sacrificial violence. A born-again ideology is the moral energy of American empire, or what Daniel Webster a long time ago described as our moral republic. The language of religious primitivism merges with the logistics of cyber empire. Weber's prophecy concerning a bleak future of specialists without spirit knits this nullity which calls itself a civilization. Asked Max Weber 100 years ago, is not, I believe, our past, but our future, with this exception. This year of 2005 is actually a double anniversary, not only the publication of Weber's The Protestant Ethic, but also the centennial of Albert Einstein's first publication of The Special Theory of Relativity. These events are not unrelated. It's my thesis that Weber's grim vision of the Iron Cage has been projected politically into history at Einstein's speed of light. Today, what I'd like to do is to brush the thought of Weber and Einstein against one another. Under the rubric of born-again ideology, I would like to think that the prophetic, desolate vision of Weber through the prism of Einstein's speed of light. The Protestant ethic has been renewed in the redemptive, passionate language of born-again Christianity. What has happened this year, this time, this day, this hour, is that we are witness now to a fateful crossing over of born-again Christianity with the power of American empire moving at the speed of light. That's born-again ideology, networked imperial power, animated by the disciplinary energies of a now resurrected Reconstructionist Christianity, moving at the speed of darkness. And why not? Long before Einstein, the United States always was a quantum country. Its foundational rhetoric never had anything to do with the modernist logic of binaries, the logic of either or. It was always a fusion, in my sense, of pre-Enlightenment subjectivity and post-human technology waiting to happen. If Einstein's special theory of relativity could speculate that light is both a waveform and a particle simultaneously, that light is both and, that opposite states exist continuously and simultaneously, this is really to only repeat in the language of quantum science the political formula that has animated American political culture from its Puritan beginnings. Namely, that this would be a culture simultaneously, at the same time, of redemptive violence and panic fear. And if Einstein could theorize against and beyond Newton's vision of a modernist entitative universe where discrete objects interact at a distance, that we live, for Einstein, in a space-time fabric moving at the speed of light, this was only to report after the fact what had long been established politically in the founding covenant of the United States. This, quote, good land, in the words of the Mayflower Compact, visualized as an imminently religious, imminently unified space to fabric of space-time, moving literally at the transcendental, epical speed of theological light. And if quantum theorists, after Einstein, could theorize that the implosive change occurs in quantum culture by virtue of what they like to describe as a tunneling effect, whereby warp holes suddenly and unpredictably open up in the space-time fabric, linking singularities from the past and the future, then I would note that this is exactly what's happening in the politics of American empire today. In an intensely technological culture, organized now, networked electronically, as a space-time fabric moving at the speed of light. This spearhead of modernity, the spearhead of technological post-modernity, a network culture as the spearhead of the digital age. A singularity from the past, the Puritan origins of religious fundamentalism, has now, I believe, actually tunneled its way into the future, precipitated by the events of 9/11. A warp hole has opened up by the waves of panic, fear, and calls for redemptive violence, which have been unleashed by the sudden disillusion, this breaching of the boundaries of the sovereign political body. A warp hole has opened up in the space-time fabric of American empire, linking two singularities, religious fundamentalism and cyberneticized global militarism, into what quantum physicists like to call a common world line. We are living now in the age of the second coming of God, and it wasn't supposed to happen this way. We all know to tears almost. We all know the Enlightenment fable of the supposed death of God. But that story, the Nietzschean myth of the death of the sacred in our Enlightenment minds, and with it the supposed triumph of the rights of reason over religious sectarianism, is, it must be admitted now, in these early days of the 21st century, increasingly specific and relative to the particularities of European late modernist experience. Like Hegel's vision of the Alba Minerva, which only takes flight at dusk, the God of the New Testament might have died in European consciousness in the age of progress, precisely because of the incarnation of a new God, the God of the Old Testament, fusing a creative crusading politics of redemptive violence and a domestic tutelary of panic fear, was actually being born at the same instant by way of the American political covenant. This second coming of God, then, is the real politics of American empire, a fateful meeting of the ancient prophecies of the Old Testament with full-spectrum futurism of cyber warfare. That's born-again ideology, and this time the rulers of the American conventicle intend to get it right, in fact, far right, with a style of political action, an unwielding politics based on preemptive action, a politics which is fascistic and follows its political formula of hand-to-mouth existence, constant military intervention, ceaselessly stirring up turbulence, provocations domestically intended to provoke panic fear among the population, for which redemptive violence is the only salvific, a style of political action which, with its scapegoating and appeals to authoritarianism, to authoritarian charismatic leadership, is hauntingly reminiscent of what Leo Lowenthal, the Frankfurt School theorist writing in exile during the 1940s, described as the imminent strategy of all fascist ideologies. So then, rapture in the American mind. To interpret the evangelical religious vision in American politics as only a useful addendum to America's political military ambitions is, I believe, to miss the point. The animating energy of the American imperial project is, I believe, essentially religious, not political. The ruling American mythopoetic is deeply eschatological. It is about end times. It is animated by a strictly religious vision of end times. It is spellbound by the imminence of the moment of rapture, that moment when political crisis unleashes this violent, desolate, and destructiveness of Armageddon prophesied by the Book of Revelations. It is enthusiastically reconstructionist, with the language of the Old Testament as its psychological horizon, as its emotional horizon of American imperialism. This is why I believe it is of more than anecdotal interest that, for example, a recent Marine operation, assault operation south of Baghdad, was codenamed Operation Plymouth Rock. Why American soldiers go into battle these days with camouflage Bibles, and why the real poignancy of that recent television image of Marines creating an impromptu baptismal fount out of spent artillery shells in order to be anointed in their terms, and you could hear their words, in the spirit of the Lord, during the fighting for Fallujah. Now, when the first pilgrims, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, crossed the waters of the Atlantic Ocean in the 17th century, their historical consciousness was truly, truly ancient. It was not modern. It was informed less by the constraints of economic necessity than by a biblical scripture, Matthew 5:14 to be exact, which provided the scriptural basis for John Winthrop's famous shipboard declaration of the Mayflower Compact during that, quote, Great Migration, where he spoke of the colony's collective destiny as the creation of a city upon a hill. These were a people of a biblical migration, whose psychogeography was a fourth order simulacra. It was their psychogeography was a virtual symbolic reality, theologically, which really had about it no reality reference other than its own closed, self-confirming, tautological, scriptural text. Literally a universal sign, populated most deeply with the voices of Daniel and Matthew in the book of Revelations and the seven-headed beast of Daniel. Listen again to the Mayflower Compact, this early rhetoric of empire which is literally burned into American governing political rhetoric, from Daniel Webster's reinvocation of the spirit of Puritanism as the essence of the American way, what he called our moral republic, on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the first encounter at Plymouth Rock, to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, to John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech, to the political rhetoric of Nixon and Reagan and Bush, father and son, and probably the next son too. This is John Winthrop, the Mayflower Compact. I quote, "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made as a story and a byword throughout the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God, which we all profess for God's sake. We shall shame the faces of many of God's worthy servants, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us, till we be consumed of the good land whither we are going." Now, what I find interesting about this founding text, burned into political rhetoric, which animates American official rhetoric of empire, is not just its yearning to be a city upon a hill, but something else, something little remarked in the utopian glow which surrounds the phrase, "We wish to be a city upon a hill." Listen to the sentence again. "If we deal falsely with our God, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." In these texts, I think, I find a fear of failure, an imminent self-doubt, really the seeds of panic fear, a subtext of political shame and evil and potential curses. In this text, there's not one America. It's not a unitary semiological text. It really is a text of two possible Americas. There are two Americas here. The much-remarked utopia of the American Republic, but also the hard-scrabble, Bible-built, unforgiving psychological territory of the fall. A feared world of shame and curses, the apocalypse of the withdrawal of the God if we fail from this good land. With this, the story of the potential American Eden, this good land to which we are going, flips in its very first instant, before the Puritans ever get on shore, into the rough country of the American Babylons of the imagination. Before the Puritans came out of the sea, the political code was firmly set. It would be a dialectic of the rise and the fall, of the war spirit and decidia, of redemptive violence and panic fear. This is what was set in motion. But to say this, let's be truthful. Aren't we also then in the 4th century North Africa with Augustine, the Bishop of Carthage, writing out the elegiac verses of the city of God and the city of man? Isn't this really the story, this mythopoetic, really the continuation of a much older story of the rise and fall of an essentially cosmological experience? Has the United States ever really managed to escape its genealogical traces in the salvational language of cosmology? George Bush today. Today, for the first time really, our vital interests and our deepest beliefs fuse. Curiously, the United States, this self-proclaimed, immensely confident spearhead of technological modernity, supposedly born as the Canadian philosopher George Grant has said in the Age of Progress, has its mythic roots in a form of consciousness that is mythic, intentionally spiritual, disciplined, giving over in the first instance to frugality and moral uprightness and disciplined labor, and later, which is now, to all the excesses of redemptive violence and panic fear, to consumer ecstasy and epochs of economic over-indebtedness. Perhaps like Michel Foucault's Sissinus Pan Pete, the Puritan pilgrims never really crossed the Atlantic. Perhaps in their minds they were always one with the children of Israel fleeing the evil Pharaoh, not Egyptian, but the royalist restoration in England, and with it the collapse of the Anglican Church into the apostasy of ceremony and the reinstallation of religious hierarchy. These really were refugees from Babylon, intent on reenacting in the New World what Barbara Tushman has described as the essence of English Cromwellian religious enthusiasm, the power of the Bible and the sword. What came ashore at Plymouth Rock was, I believe, the premonitory shadow of the last man of Nietzsche's Zarathustra, a fully armed spirit of Nietzschean resentment, an exiled religious community fleeing persecution in England and fleeing indifference in Holland, separatist, infused with the spirit of the religious elect, and most of all sexually perverse in its relationship to the body. The founding of America never was about political economy. It was always about libidinal economy. It was about an obsessive disciplinary attitude to the body, which read Old Testament phantasmagoria into the body's desire, aggressively policing the bodies of women and parishioners and indigenous peoples. Separatists, resentful, hardened in the bitter anvil of European religious struggles, filled with the spirit of election, obsessed to the point of sexual perversity with suppressing the body's libido, the Puritans came ashore as an eschatology, a hard, cold vision of end times just waiting its chance for full historical expression. Now, close in just 1 second. Give me 7 minutes. Now, much has been made of the capitalist origins of the American experiment, but less so the origins of American exceptionalism in the psychogeography of the Old Testament. The very terms which trace the horizon of the so-called American dream, the American covenant, the city upon a hill, indicate that governing American rhetoric is steeped in the ancient testimony of the Old Testament. Everything else is, I believe, at present, derivative, blasted away in the contemporary fundamentalist turn to the primitive vision of the spirit of Puritan nihilism which came out of the sea at Plymouth Rock. It is as if for one brief historical moment, which has now been effectively eclipsed, the light of political reason, hard won from religious persecution and exhaustion of Europe's unending religious wars, dims again as the foundation of the American mind, in the language of religious eschatology, asserts itself anew. Now, thought from a critical liberal perspective, the Puritan tradition represents a continuous but episodic moment in the American mind, where the forces of reaction break out from the silence of many hearts fueled by resentment into the public passions of zealotry and scapegoating. Witness in the United States the history of abolitionism and McCarthyism, of race baiting and union baiting and sex baiting, or the anti-terrorist campaign signaled by the U.S. and the U.S. Patriot Act. Understood from the liberal humanist side of the dialectic of reason, this may well be the case, but in terms of diagnosing the genealogy of the politics of American empire, I just don't think it's correct. We should listen anew and listen really intently to what the Puritans had to say, for theirs is, I believe, the foundational creed of contemporary American politics. Certainly not in its specifics. Their calls for frugality and self-discipline and bodily sequestration have disappeared under the surface of consumer capitalism and the society of the spectacle. The last man, really, is bunkered down now in front of a 60-inch plasma TV, surround sound pumped up full volume, terrorized by the media by threats of viral terrorism, but delighted at secondhand by the media spectacle of military apocalypse visiting an always accidental enemy. But for all of this, founding codes run deep. The spirit of Puritanism hasn't disappeared, provoked by the classic symptomology of resentment. Someone has to pay for my feeling ill, Nietzsche. It might even have intensified. The rhetoric of exceptionalism, America's a city upon a hill, bonded in the beginning as in the present to a predestined covenant with God, is the essence of American political consciousness. Now call it what you will, the American dream, the founding covenant, the redemptive empire, it's the animating rhetoric of moral exceptionalism, which if it does faithful in advance to the later political theories of Carl Schmitt and Giorgio Agamben, provided justification for the moral rightness of the cold power of the imperial state in determining who is and who isn't subject to the language of the exception, this shouldn't distract our vision from the essentially religious nature of the American calling, nor from its uniqueness in linking together in the experiment of a moral republic, an essentially Old Testament version of Christianity, with a new republican version of neoconservative politics. Appeals now for faith-based politics and faith-based public policy, faith-based governance and commerce and science and education do not, I believe, represent something new in American political discourse, but a return to an original unity of discourse where science and religion and governance and faith are the very essence of the new covenant that always was America. And I'll conclude with three sentences, and thank you for your patience. With the re-election of George W. Bush, the Puritan vision of a city upon a hill finds its articulation in a renewed interest in the language of theonomy and denominationalism. And I mean this literally. With Pat Robertson of the 700 Club, President Bush is a self-proclaimed premillennial dispensationalist. Premillennial dispensationalist. As opposed to other warring camps in Reconstructionist Christianity, Bush is held to believe that the moment of rapture, literally, the second coming of Christ, will be brought about by a certain constellation of political events prophesied in the Old Testament, most famously the reunification of Israel and the rebuilding of the Temple of Solomon on the Temple Mount. He also affirms with his closest advisors that he is in a unique executive historical position to make this happen. He is widely viewed by many members of born-again Christianity in the United States to be God's chosen sign of the elect, the long-anticipated sign of the coming of the moment of rapture, with its prophesied division of the transcendent Christian elect for the vast multitude that will be, quote, left behind. The psychosis of these new pagans occupies the highest offices of the politics of empire. So, just stop.